The Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has insisted that forthcoming changes to special education provision in England are not about removing support. The full details of the plans are due to be announced tomorrow. The Conservatives say they have big concerns. Ms Phillipson told Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One that more money would be invested.
This is going to be a decade-long transformation, a decade-long reform that will be carefully managed, done with parents, with better outcomes for children right at the heart. And I'll be publishing all of the full detail tomorrow. And I hope that when parents read that and review that, they will see that this is all about investing now to deliver a transformed system.
The government has said it will look at the student loan system after the Conservatives pledged to cap the interest rate charged to some graduates. Ministers have accused the Tories of complaining about loans they introduced when they were in power. Our political correspondent Nick Eardley says he expects the government to come under continued pressure.
I do think the pressure on the government on this is going to grow and grow and grow, not least because the opposition now have a costed plan to say this is a way that you can bring these interest rates down and make them more manageable for people who have that student debt. Whether the government decides to follow suit, they don't seem to be in that place just yet. But as I say, I don't think this one's going to go away.
President Zelensky says Russia attacked Ukraine with 50 missiles and nearly 300 drones overnight. Speaking 2 days before the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion, he said the attacks targeted Ukraine's energy sector and residential buildings. Students in Iran have protested against the government for the first time since last month's deadly crackdown. Yesterday, demonstrators marched in Tehran, chanting death to the dictator, referring to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. At the Winter Olympics, Team GB's Zoe Atkin has won bronze in the free ski halfpipe.
I'm so happy. I mean, I've been looking forward to this for at least the past 4 years. And honestly, it was just so overwhelming coming here, you know, with the crowd and just knowing that it was the Olympics, like so many emotions. I was so stressed out. I was crying. And to put two runs down felt so good. And then on the cherry on top, getting on the Olympic podium means so much to me.
And now the weather. A brighter afternoon in southern parts of England. Chance of rain in the north and west. And that's the BBC News and weather at 2 minutes past 12, where now on Radio 3, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Asif Khan is a world-renowned architect whose work inspired the recent headline, "Is there anything Asif Khan can't transform?" His current projects include the reinvention of the former Smithfield Meat Market into the new London Museum and the extensive renewal of the Barbican Centre. Further afield in Kazakhstan, he's turned a vast former Soviet cinema into a new cultural centre. He opened his own studio in 2007 and has designed exhibitions, temporary pavilions and installations around the world. He views architecture as a multidisciplinary field, bringing together design, science and art. Well, actually, your music, Asif, is multidisciplinary in a way, because we're going to hear Chopin, Shostakovich, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan and Brian Eno. But I think we're going to start with Liszt.
Yes, the piece Un Sospiro is something which stirs my soul, and it's also a piece that I'm continually trying to learn how to play. It's one of those long-term projects which I keep returning to.
What is it about the music, do you think, that you feel so attracted to?
There's a sensory quality to it. It is like floating or flying through time and space, and when I play it, and not very well, there's something that your body does in crossing hands where it fills you. And so you're physically acting out the music, and that's just an extraordinary thing.
Well, let's hear the third concert study in D-flat major by Liszt, played not by you, sadly, but by Van Cliburn.
Thank you.
Music by Liszt, Ansel Spiro, the Étude de Concert No. 3 in D-flat major, played by Van Cliburn. You must be doing quite well with the piano. It's not that easy, that piece.
I'm sort of halfway through a piece of music.
Do you play other instruments as well, Asif?
At 8 years old, we had a chance to take on an instrument at school, and you had a choice between viola, violin, and cello, and I chose the cello. I think it was bigger than me at the time. It felt like a better object to be walking around with. I play the guitar. I used to be a very average contributor to a band in my
I know
teens.
The feeling.
Actually, our house has got quite a few instruments. It's got a drum kit, which my daughter was learning, but I sort of took on a little bit as well, and some Kazakh instruments for my wife. So we've got a dombra and a kobuz, which are beautiful stringed instruments. One is played by the bow and one is plucked.
Gosh, quite a collection then. Your father came from generations of farmers, didn't he? But your mother, she grew up in Tanzania?
That's right. Mum and dad are both, you know, from the Indian subcontinent. But mum, her ancestry comes from Gujarat in West India. My grandfather in his teens went on a boat to Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, as did a lot of Indians. And he worked in his uncle's shop and in his own right became a businessman and shopkeeper in Iringa. He had a bicycle shop, but it was a bicycle shop that sold everything from from musical instruments, incidentally,
yeah,
to tailoring even. They did tailoring as well. And my mum grew up in that environment. And then in 1965 came to London to study. And my dad came in 63, but from Pakistan. He's Punjabi. And in fact, both parents have different mother tongues. So my mom's Gujarati and Kutchi speaking. My dad is Punjabi and Urdu speaking. So at home, our language was English, actually, which is why I'm terrible at those languages.
Well, we've got some Indian classical music next, haven't we? What have you chosen?
When I think about my childhood at home, I was lucky to have music around all the time, and it was really my dad who would play classical Indian music or Western classical music, both of those, and sometimes jazz. And this is one of the records that he would play. It's called Call of the Valley. From what he told me, music was one of the things that sort of kept him alive. I think he struggled to find happiness for a while away from being so far away from home. He was, you know, working in factories and shops to build up enough savings to be able to do a university degree as a mature student.
I think questioning him about the music, for this programme in fact, took you into realms that you hadn't been in before with him, didn't it?
That's right. In 68, he told me that whilst he was working at Barker's, John Barker's, which is a department store on Kensington High Street, he would go that summer every evening to the BBC Proms concerts. And he would stand, and he said it's one of the greatest summers of his life. I mean, he told me this yesterday. I never knew about it. And that's where the classical music really began to sort of live inside him. And then he told me that he traveled to Vienna and Salzburg hitchhiking, I think in 67 or 68, and saw Herbert von Karajan conduct the Easter Festival. And he said, seeing this man conduct is just extraordinary, the charisma. And he hasn't explained them to me before. He's now 85. It was quite a cathartic moment to release that, and I feel the music is a greater inheritance than I realized.
That's fascinating. And one of the things about this program is the way music opens up memories and emotions. This raga that we're going to hear, I think, tells the story of the life of a shepherd. So it takes your father back to Pakistan and gives you a memory of childhood too.
you know, the flute is so powerful in this, and it evokes landscape.
It's floating again, isn't it? It's another dream world, like the list.
If you'd ask anyone from our family or friends, well, it's a soundtrack of my parents' house, and it's this feeling.
Part of Ragadesh Dadra, performed by Hari Prasad Chaurasia. Well, I mentioned in the introduction that you're involved with the redevelopment of the Barbican Centre, but that has a very special place in your family history, doesn't it?
My sister and I were transported there every weekend since 1982. So since I was born in 79 and I was a toddler, I was brought there a few weeks after it opened, and then continually from, you know, into my teens. I don't know why, but my dad was determined to bring our family there and treat it as a living room. So those spaces, the lakeside and the foyer, were a place where my sister and I would just play and run around, and there were concerts, you know, on the weekends and things that were in the public spaces. In fact, we never saw any paid concerts there. I didn't even know it was a concert hall until much later. And I think that, you know, my parents were both social workers, and there wasn't a lot of disposable income. Yeah, but being there, you felt it was yours. You know, this enormous public space. And I asked my dad, why were we there? Why were we brought there? And he said, you know what? It reminded me of the Shalimar Gardens in Lahore. And even with my architectural training, I'd never noticed that the lakeside was modeled on a Mughal garden. And it's an observation that my dad made, and it's never been made by anyone. But when I looked into it before the competition interview, because architectural projects are won through competition, it turned out that the three architects, Chamberlain, Powell, and Bonn was Swiss, Chamberlain, Powell were British, but Powell was born in Bangalore in India. Chamberlain had visited India and was taken on tour by Jeffrey Bauer, the great Sri Lankan architect. So the two of them had been aware of the great architecture of the East as well as the great architecture of the West. So my dad felt that it was a home away from home. And then he made it our home. I told my dad that I'd won the competition to renew the center, and that I wanted to give the next generation of people like us, or like me, the chance to have what I had. And we both started crying. We were in the Barbican, we both started crying. And maybe it's a gift of music, and it's a gift of culture from one generation to the other that I felt very privileged to be part of.
Miriam Makeba next.
Well, I mentioned my mum is Tanzanian by birth, and Miriam Makeba wasn't Tanzanian, she was South African, Xhosa. But I think this song brought the Swahili language, which is one of my mum's mother tongues, to the global ear in a way. And when I hear this, it makes me feel in the embrace of my mother. It's a love song. Malaika means angel, but this story is that this man who's singing to his angel, he says, I'm so poor, I can't afford to give you things. So it's a love song, but also a lament, or maybe it has a possibility that love won't be able to be satisfied.
Let's hear Miriam Makeba.
Ladies and gentlemen, this next song comes from Tanzania. It's a song in Swahili, a love song. It simply says, Malaika nakupenda malaika, which simply means, I love you, my angel. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ningekuwa madiwe, ningekuwa wadada. Nashindwa na mali sina we, ningekuwa wa malaika. Nashindwa na mali sina we. nifanyeje kijana mwenzio nashinda na malisi no we ningekuwa wa malaika nashinda na malisi no we wo ningekuwa wa malaika kidege hukuwaza kidege kidege hukuwaza kidege nami nifanyeje kijana mwenzio nashinda na malisi na we wo ningekuwa wa malaika nashinda na malisi na we ningekuwa wa malaika.
A live recording of Miriam Makeba performing the Tanzanian folk song Malaika. When you weren't dreaming, Asif, with all this music, what did you excel in at school? What did you like studying at school? What subjects were you good at?
I think I was quite average. When I was very young, I think I was more of a scientist. And I would spend a lot of time when I was at home taking things apart, figuring out how they work, put them back together. I would fix things. I mean, I took the back of the TV once. I don't know why there were no rules in our house, but I think my parents probably saw it as educational. So there was an interest in science, and I was terrible at sports. Very thin, gangly little boy.
You're quite tall.
I'm quite tall. My dad is really tall. We're not really built for sports. No, I tended to find diversion doing things that weren't on the curriculum. And I don't mean naughty things, but we would, with a group of friends, we would set ourselves little projects, and they would be making short films, improvised comedy sketches, making music. You know, one person would have a camcorder, another one would have a VCR. I bought a dubbing machine and a microphone. And with the kit that we'd bring to each other's houses, we made a little production studio, really. And, you know, I was good with wiring things up. So I would twist all the cables together and get things to work.
So when did you fix on becoming an architect?
You know, originally I wanted to be a doctor. And I even went to medical interviews after my A-levels and got a place. And I realized whilst I was doing these interviews that there was no space for creativity, at least in the way that I saw it or that I wanted to do it. And I was helping some friends prepare their portfolios for architecture school because I was good at drawing and painting. And when I was helping them, they were telling me about what the course entailed. I thought, wow, that combines the creative urges that I have or abilities with, you know, research. It really is a hybrid of all of man's knowledge, because it requires you to harness nature and culture and resources and hopefully art as well to bring things and elevate society. I just became enthralled with it as a possibility.
There was a slight glitch in your path to success, wasn't there? Because I think you failed your first year at architecture school. Sorry to remind
you. No. You know, it's one of the best things that's ever happened to me. And I think a lot of people would say that about failures. They teach you about yourself and they are the greatest motivator. And I think I'd got myself trapped in overthinking things. And so by the end of the school year, the university year, I didn't have very much, and I had to, in a space of a few days, try and conjure up a project, and it didn't really happen. And my teacher said, go and work in a practice for a few months and come back and finish your final project, and I promise you, you'll be a different person. And it was absolutely right. I worked in a really straightforward architecture practice doing waiting rooms for hospitals. And I did that for 6 months, went back into school, and I was on fire. I was a different person. I would embark on drawings which were 10 meters long. I'd paste up a roll of tracing paper on the wall and spend 2 or 3 weeks on a single drawing, 10 meters long. And I think I fell in love with the discipline and also the process, and that I think it's Picasso who says that the inspiration comes when you're working. I've never put down the pencil since.
That's fascinating. We're going to hear Pavarotti next. Is this because of the voice or the song?
Both, actually. So from my father, I think I inherited this love of the Western classical music, jazz, and Indian classical music. From my mum's side, my mum's oldest brothers, there comes opera and opera music. And I remember, as I'm sure a lot of people do, in the 90s, encountering this CD, The Essential Pavarotti. Had a grey cover and a portrait of Pavarotti on the front with a red background. It's this iconic thing. And from this CD was released this voice that my uncles would fill their houses with. If you stayed at their house on the weekend, it was loud, really loud, booming through the house.
Guido per il mare luce e tira forte il vento su una vecchia terrazza davanti al golfo di Sorrento. Un uomo abbraccia una ragazza dopo che aveva pianto. Poi si schiarisce la voce e ricomincia il canto. Te voglio bene assai, ma tanto, tanto bene assai. È una catena ormai che scioglie il sangue di te. In mezzo al mare penso alle notti là in America, ma erano solo le lampare e la bianca scia d'un'elica. Senti il dolore della musica, si alzò dal piano forte, ma quando vide la luna uscire da una nuvola mi sembrò più dolce anche la morte. Guardò negli occhi la ragazza, quegli occhi verdi come il mare. all'improvviso uscì una lacrima e lui credette d'affogare. Te voglio bene, ma tanto, tanto bene, è una catena ormai che scioglie il sangue di te bene. Potenza della lirica, dove ogni dramma è un falso, che con un po' di trucco e con la mimica puoi diventare un altro. Ma due occhi che ti guardano, così vicini e fermi, ti fai scordare le parole, confondono i pensieri. Così diventa tutto piccolo, anche le notti là in America. Ti volti e vedi la tua vita come la scia d'un'elica. Ma sì, è la vita che finisce, ma lui non ci pensò poi tanto, anzi si sentiva già felice e ricominciò il suo canto. Te voglio bene assai, ma tanto, tanto bene, è una catena ormai che scioglie il sangue di te.
This is actually my karaoke song.
I want to see that and hear it.
It requires a very different state of body and mind for it to happen.
We heard Luciano Pavarotti singing Caruso by Lucio Dalla, and the Bologna Municipal Theatre Orchestra were accompanying him. You never actually went, Asif, to work with a big architectural firm before setting up your own practice. That takes some courage.
I once went on a tour of Norman Foster's office when I was 19, I think, and it was amazing. Enormous, enormous place even then. Thousands of people working there. And, of course, that was exciting. But what I was really dreaming about was to be in an environment where this creative energy, which I had when I was a teenager, you know, doing those like crazy projects with my friends, I wanted an environment where I could harness that. So I was actually looking for small projects and small ways to build up an understanding of this art form. And when I was in my fifth year of school, I did a lecture about my university projects in the real world, which was quite unusual to do that as a student. And I met my first client, Jane Wood, who I would then, 1 year later, build a project in Littlehampton for.
A small beach cafe.
Yeah, it's a really, really cute little cafe serving fish and chips on the beach.
It's still there.
It is still there. Yeah. It's gone through some renovation, which I wasn't part of, but it means so much to me, that place in the world. And I'd drive out there in my mum's Vauxhall Corsa and check on the site and work with local craftsmen. And having that close relationship with the client and building the trust and listening to, you know, being told off sometimes, and also making them excited about the project, excited about the work, is something, it's just an extraordinary feeling. And this is something, once you've done it once, you want to fill your life with those sort of moments. It's not easy. It's a really hard process.
You mentioned how Norman Foster's studio had thousands of people working away. So would you like just to paint a little picture for us of your studio?
You mentioned before that I'm multidisciplinary, and I've tried to stay that way. So we have... The studio is divided into two. It's in an old carpet warehouse in Hackney, near Broadway Market. Half of the studio is a workshop where you can make things from wood, from metal, make casts from plaster. And this space is there to make prototypes and test the way things are put together. So it might be a door, it might be a junction of a piece of wood, it might be a detail. Sometimes it's an architectural model in as you'd imagine it, a small model of a building. But in that space, we've done all sorts of experiments, you know, with water, with materials that people might not know of, like Vantablack. I think we've pushed boundaries in sound and film and different materials there that have then influenced projects in the real world. And the other half of the studio is where I think how people would imagine it, there's 20 or 30 computers and people, an extraordinary team of people working, doing plans and sections and detailed drawings. But I've always encouraged people to move between those two worlds, to design and then test and then go back to the design. It's a great blessing to be able to have both sides, the virtual and the physical, at the same time. And I think it makes you a better designer to be able
Talking
to
of the physical, you have a climbing wall, don't you?
I do have a climbing I have a climbing wall in my studio too. We spend a lot of time hunched over desks and, as you said, drawing boards as well. You know, so that physical exercise is really important. And originally, I built the wall during lockdown because my daughter was really into climbing and all the climbing gyms had closed in London. And it was built to test some of the machines that we had bought. And we made a little project during lockdown and we built this thing. My daughter is now 19 and she's in the British climbing team. So she's graduated beyond this wall, our studio wall at the moment. But I still really enjoy doing it, but I do injure myself a lot, fingers and knees and back. Nothing works as well as it used to.
Safer perhaps to stay with the piano.
That's it. I'm trying to get back into it actually at the moment, but I had a big heart operation just over a year ago. It was a genetic condition I found, and I had to have a kind of life-saving operation, and through the process of recovery I developed a different way of thinking about my body, and I think I'm more careful now, and I'm just trying to get back into the swing of things in both mind and body.
Chopin, the piano concerto number 2.
Yeah, this piece is a very close friend of mine and it guided me through many times in my teens where I would use it as a sort of antidepressant. I was never very good at exams, and I would spend most of my time when I was meant to be revising just staring out of the window looking at clouds, and this piece of music was like the accompaniment to the clouds.
The second movement of Chopin's Piano Concerto No. 2 in F minor, played by István Széke with the Hungarian National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Gyula Németh. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the architect, Asif Khan. One of the major projects you've been involved in the last couple of years, Asif, has been in Kazakhstan, in the city of Almaty, transforming one of the largest Soviet cinemas into the country's first independent cultural center. Was that a very wide-ranging job?
The center is called Tselini. It opened last year, and it's the sort of culmination of now 8 years of work. Tselini was a cinema that was built in 1964 to celebrate the 10th anniversary of Khrushchev's campaign of appropriating all of the Kazakh historic and sacred steppe landscape and committing it to this kind of enormous agricultural project that would feed the Soviet Union. And they named the cinema, which is the greatest kind of cultural attraction in the city, after that campaign. So within this building was both a kind of colonial narrative, but also it was a fun palace. It was also a place where people would go and have their first date and go and enjoy movies. But it declined into the 80s and 90s. And by the 2000s, the cinema was in really bad condition. And I was asked to go and look at it and transform it into a cultural center.
The original building blocked the view of the cathedral, didn't it?
That's right. The Tselini cinema was built to block the sunrise from hitting the church that was behind it. So it was a sort of statement from the government that there was a new show in town and it wasn't involving religion. As part of the project to renew the building, I couldn't remove it and just reveal the church. And we did explore the idea of changing the height of it, but sometimes the process of transformation is just about disarming something and unlocking possibilities there. So if you think about cinema, it is an internal world. You go in there, into the cinema, into a dark space. You're given light for 2 hours, and then you leave back into the real world. The first act we did on the building was to strip out the cinema, and we brought daylight into that space. The second thing we did was we discovered a Soviet sgraffito, which is it's a kind of mural that's made by scraping into plaster. And the sgraffito was made in 1964. It's one of the largest such murals in the world. It's 42 meters wide, but it was covered by plasterboard and thought to be lost. It's an extraordinary scene of, on one side, traditional Kazakh life on the great steppe, you know, herding animals and eating apples from the tree. Of course, apples, the birthplace of the apple is Kazakhstan, you know, and Alma-Ata means grandfather of apples. And on the mural, the same mural on the right-hand side, the traditional Kazakhs were reading books and had been somehow civilized by the Soviet influence. Although it carried a kind of complex narrative, people loved this this mural. So one of the big projects we've done is to repair that original sgraffito. And it's when you enter this building, you discover that in front of you in all its glory. But we've changed its color palette. So it's now muted. So it sounds like a very subtle thing to do, but to change the color of history is a way to diffuse, in a way, the past and give artists of the present day a blank slate to create their own work. So it was a way of inviting in the creativity of today's artists of Kazakhstan.
You had to think of things like geography and earthquakes, didn't you, when you were doing this?
Yeah, there is a big earthquake coming. There was an enormous one in the early 1900s. So part of the project was seismic strengthening, which complicates everything. And there was a group of engineers locally who wanted to knock down the building, and we had to persuade them, along with our client, to believe in the possibility of it standing through the next earthquake. And a lot of the decisions we made were tempered by that you know, possibility.
We've actually got music next, which is called Kazakhstan.
So this is a piece of music that Brian Eno composed for a project which I made for the World Expo when it was in Astana, the capital city of Kazakhstan. And it's quite extraordinary. It was played through 24 speakers. Although we'll hear it as a singular piece, when you were in the space itself, your mind and your ears would mix their own version depending on which speakers you were within. Maybe I can paint a picture of the space that this music accompanied. There was a yurt in the center of this enormous room, darkness. But the yurt was made out of materials that emanated light. And around the yurt was a 360-degree panoramic screen. And on that panoramic screen was a film that I'd made, which shows a day evolving over the period of minutes. So sun rises, the clouds go past, wind blows, rain, and so on, and then it goes to nightfall. So there's a rhythm of a sort of human day. And you walked down a dark corridor towards the sun, and as you walked down this corridor, you'd hear the first tone of Brian's music, and then it reached its sort of peak as you entered the yurt. It was the music that was playing when I met my wife.
Momentous in many ways. Part of Brian Eno's Kazakhstan, you use music directly in your contribution to the 2012 Olympics, the beatbox.
Yes.
Sounds fun.
There's a tradition in the Olympic Games of building not only venues, but also exhibitions and pavilions. And, you know, it's been going on since the 1920s. I think Coca-Cola built a pavilion in 26, since when they started their sponsorship. And I found it very interesting to connect music and performance and architecture together and proposed a structure where people can play the building like a musical instrument. I wanted to take people on a journey from the ground up to the top of this building. There's a spiral ramp that's about 200 meters long. And on that journey, there are surfaces that people touch that have the same kind of technology that's in your phone that responds to touch. But different sounds emerge from music and beats recorded by the musician Mark Ronson to the drawing of an arrow string or the hitting of a ping pong ball. So in that building, every visitor, and I think there were 250,000 visitors, becomes both an audience member and a performer in a singular piece of music.
Well, we've got a singular piece of music next, and it's another lyrical movement from a piano concerto, which I think you also used in your work. It's the slow movement of the piano concerto number 2 in F major by Shostakovich.
This is a piece which is, it's just so extraordinary. Shostakovich composed it for his son Maxim to perform at his graduation. So it's a debut for Maxim, but also it's a gift from a father to a son. And I spoke about that earlier, how you know, I feel I've received so many gifts from my dad in music. I recently designed a show for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, which is all about the history of Cartier and its jewelry, its influences, the way that it connected the world, you know, East and West, through the influences that it had. And the final room of that is a debutante's ball of tiaras. And you have about 20 tiaras in the room, which have come from some of the most important collections in the world. And I wanted to use a piece of music that would, I think, create this dreamlike atmosphere, make people feel they'd entered into a ball.
Well, let's go straight to that lovely melody at the opening of this movement. The Andante movement from Shostakovich's Piano Concerto No. 2 in F major, performed by I Musici de Montreal, with Maxim Shostakovich conducting and his son, Dmitri Shostakovich Jr., playing the piano. Asif Khan, tell us about the extraordinary gates that you designed in Dubai in 2020. They were positioned around the city. What do they look like?
They're over 20 meters tall. They look like they're threaded out of a fine textile. And in fact, they are. They're made from carbon fiber, which is a material that we know of from Formula One and from aerospace industries. And it's something extraordinary because it defies gravity. It allows you to do things which are impossible with conventional materials because it's so light and yet so strong. So in 2020, there was going to be the Expo in Dubai. There's a spirit of Expo that began at the Great Exhibition in London in 1852. And Joseph Paxton there designed the Crystal Palace in iron and glass at a scale which had never been seen on Earth before. In fact, it was the largest building on Earth at the time in 1852. And I think it set the mold of all of the glass and steel buildings we see in the world today. I felt I had to continue in this lineage, use Expo as a place to demonstrate a new possibility for architecture. But also the question was how to make something that is both able to speak of the culture, the local culture, and also speak to the future of our global culture. So I don't know if you're familiar with these lattice screens that you see all over the kind of Islamic world, like mashrabiyas.
And in Spain too.
Exactly. Yeah. If you go to Granada, you'll see them on the windows, and at the same time, you'll see them in North Africa and the Middle East. And I thought to myself, what if we could make a mashrabiya out of carbon fiber? Could every line be both a line of meaning and geometry, but also a line of force? So this structure, it's both incredibly light and airy and provides shade, but it's also a demonstration of the possibilities of structural engineering.
You also exhibited an artwork at the Islamic Art Biennale in Jeddah.
Yeah, that was... I was inspired by a verse in the Quran, which I'd known about for a long time. It's called the Ayat An-Nur. Nur means light in Arabic. And it attempts to describe the majesty of the universe, the majesty of the divine, as not just light, but light upon light. And so I started to think of a project where the Quran would be not just a book, but itself a vessel, an emanator of light itself. And I used pages made out of glass. The glass was 0.1 millimeters thick, so thinner than hair, and even my hair, even thinner than my hair. and on those, there's 604 pages, and on each of them in gold lettering are the words of the verses, and then all of those pages stacked upon each other. So if you look at it in a single glance, it appears as a glass block, but on closer inspection, it's all 77,000 words of the Quran, and you can see straight through it. And light travels through this glass and illuminates all words at one time.
We're going to hear a great Pakistani musician now, Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
I think for people from a Pakistani background, Nusrat was a sort of extraordinary ambassador for the country, but also I think took Qawwali, which is essentially devotional music, to a global stage. This particular piece, it is a love song to the divine, you know, to God. So it's a devotional song, but it's also a love song, we could say, from ourselves to another loved one.
It's called Nothing Without You. Thank you. Nothing Without You by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan with Terry Bina. Asif Khan, can we take, as we're coming towards the end of the programme, a peek at the work you're doing in the centre of London, a new museum in Smithfield, part of which will open later this year. What drew you to this project and its possibilities?
Yeah, I'm very interested in time and how we exist in a city as a continuum that might be thousands of years of lives and moments. And a museum of a city is one of the most extraordinary things, because it's not just about artifacts from the past. It's almost a crucible for determining what the future of that city might be like. The London Museum site takes on the derelict part of Smithfield Meat Market. And that piece of Smithfield has, for almost 1,000 years, been a place where animals were slaughtered and executions would happen. William Wallace's memorial is there. Dickens, in Oliver Twist, says it's a place of filth and fat and blood and foam and intolerable cruelty from man to man and man to beast. You know, it was an awful place. And the idea that we might transform that into a place for children and families to have a day out is extraordinary. But it's also a profound act then, you know, of change. I think it's the first museum in the world that will have essentially a piece of high street as its facade. And the inside of the museum will have vast public spaces originally built by Horace Jones, who was the city architect of the time, you know, when the building was built first in the 1880s, and cavernous underground spaces with, you know, some of the objects from the museum's 7 million object collection. So this is an extraordinary new place for London to learn about itself, but also for visitors to become participants in the city's future.
And there's a live train that runs alongside the lower galleries, isn't there? Visitors will be able to see trains running past.
Yeah, well, you couldn't make it up.
You have made it up.
Well, so every 5 or 10 minutes, there's a rumble in the distance, and it's a Thames Link train passing by. And of course, this building was originally built at this peak of the empire, peak of Industrial Revolution. So every technology available was put into it, including meat arriving by train. Mm-hmm. So it would arrive by train and leave by horse.
And not far from the Barbican, where we began and where you toddled.
That's right. Although we've gone on this journey around the world, I haven't really gone very far.
And do you think this thing about public spaces possibly takes you right back to your parents' work as social workers and the way you were treated as children?
I think very much so. I'm starting to believe that architecture is a form of social work. There are other projects which are about self-discovery and about pushing boundaries of human experience, but there's something about doing something for your neighbourhood and for your community that is, it's like saying thank you and hopefully inspiring the next generation of people like me to do the same kind of thing.
Well, it's time for me to say thank you to you as we finish with a piece from a Kazakh singer. Why have you chosen this?
I mentioned languages before, and in my household there's really a landscape of languages. The children from my first marriage are Japanese-speaking. We have Urdu, Punjabi, Swahili, Kachi, Gujarati. And my wife is from Kazakhstan, so we have Kazakh and Russian as well. Over the years, I've grown a love of music from Central Asia, both the instruments which are in our house, but also the new wave of Kazakh vocalists. Moldan Azar is a vocalist who he's just got a beautiful tone and expressiveness. Within it, I still feel the spirit of my wife's ancestors. And so we used it as the music in our wedding, and I felt that when she arrived at the wedding and this music was playing, that her people were walking with her.
That's a very nice thought to end on. So, Asif Khan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. It's just a real honour to be here.
Sir. Сырымыз бітпей жалғасты таңға Жағымды шаңғы Мен дарман бар ма? Қоштасып ұзақ кетуге қимай кеудеме сыймай махаббатым ғашықпын саған еркем нәзіксің Қоштасып ұзақ кетуге қимай, кеудеме сыймай махаббатым.
Махаббатым, composed and performed by Molda Nazar. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the architect and designer Asif Khan. The programme was produced by Katie Hickman. Next week, Michael's guest will be Peter Hamlin, the founder and president of the Brain and Spine Foundation. Well, I hope you're having a good Sunday so far. Good afternoon. Emily Jeffrey here with you on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds. Music Map on the way very shortly. Then at 3, we're in Oxford for Choral Evensong.
Get ready for the 2026 BAFTAs with me, Edith Bowman, and Sound of Cinema.
Everything is so beautiful in this film.
The multi-award-winning composer Alexandre Desplat talks about his BAFTA-nominated score to Frankenstein.
It's offered to me to add music to that. It's a gift.
And there's music from this year's other nominees too. Max Richter, Ludwig Göransson, Johnny Greenwood, and Jerskin Fendrix. Sound of Cinema from BBC Radio 3. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 3, it's time for Sarah Moore-Peach to work her way towards another musical destination.
Four hundred years ago, almost exactly to the day, they laid the Elizabethan composer John Dowland to rest. This is his Pavane Lacrimae Antiquae, a slow dance of ancient tears, and it's the first of a set of seven pavanes for viol consort by Dowland, which we're exploring this afternoon here on Radio 3. Welcome to Music Map. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach, and over the next hour and a half, we'll be delving into other music of melancholy, exploring the impact of Dowland's music on future generations, and leaning heavily into laments. Dowland published his Seven Tears, the Lacrimae, in 1604, and they are, to all intents and purposes, a set of seven variations on a song that Dowland had already written 4 years earlier and published as one of his first book of lute songs, The song is called Flow My Tears, and we'll hear it in a moment. But let's begin our map with another composer writing a set of variations on his own song.